Okay, and welcome to episode number 58 of Shockwaves. Wow, we're up to 58. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Rebecca McKendry.
Hi. Up? I am back from Canada.
You are?
Yes.
Ryan's back from Canada, but he's not back in the room yet, apparently.
Ryan had to take a call.
He's running around. He's taking care of business.
He'll be back momentarily,
Lots
though.
Of business. So it's just the three of us. Elric is in New York, so sorry about that. But we got a lot to talk about, and we've got a wonderful guest, somebody that we've been wanting to have on. God, I feel like we say that every week at this point.
Yeah, but it's true. We definitely have like a list of people that we have been wanting to have on for a really long time. Like we always have kind of our dream guests, and this guy has been mentioned many times before.
I mean, who wouldn't want to talk to Ted Raimi?
That's all I got to say. Right? I hope he wears
that. You see that name? Yeah, you're hoping he's
I
wearing
hope
a suit.
He wears the suit.
Yeah, me too. So yeah, let's jump right in, at least until Ryan gets back. But first and foremost, we have to mention a few things. Let's do our plug. Midsummer Scream is this weekend.
Yes, we are at the Midsummer Scream Convention in Long Beach this weekend.
Long Beach, California.
Yeah.
There is a Long Beach in New York.
Oh, there is. Oh, you're right. It just dawned on me. Long Beach, California. So we will be there on Saturday. We're doing a live show at 1 p.m. Our theme is Sharksploitation,
and
we have a guest.
Oh, who is our guest?
Rob Schraub.
That's right. That
yes.
is correct. He's going to be joining us for that discussion because he's a big fan, apparently.
Yeah. And so
and he's the writer of Monster House, and he's done tons of TV stuff. We were just, I think Brian ran into him at some VHS like swap meet.
Yeah. The one like, in downtown a couple of weeks ago. And he was like, they totally geeked out on shark movies. So that's awesome. So he's going to join us on there. And this is kicking off our exploitation month. So for the next couple of weeks, all of our shows will kind of be geared toward exploitation. We've got a lot of great guests coming up. But yeah, this first episode is at Midsummer Scream Con. And so if you are in the Los Angeles, Long Beach area, please come check us out Saturday at 1 p.m. We will be live on stage. And afterwards, everybody will be signing, including Devin Whitehead, who made our awesome
Shocker shirt.
Yeah, the Shocker shirt. And we will be signing at the Evil Squared booth.
Excellent. So come and see us there. And if you are not in Los Angeles, worry not. This will actually be a live episode that we record for next week. So you'll be able to hear it that way. So that's the first order of business. Second, it's weird because we, even though our episodes went up as scheduled, we had recorded the Gary Sherman one a couple of weeks ago to accommodate his schedule. And in the interim, we lost George Romero. I had to record a little snippet for last episode just so we acknowledge that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Mart Landau, the same day. Obviously, you know, his performance as Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood, and he was in The Being with Jackie Kong. She told us that great story about how
she took
his acting class to convince him to be in her movie, which I thought was amazing. And Alone in the Dark, which is a really bizarre little 80s movie from a horror movie from the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of days ago, John Hurd, who was in Cat People and Chud and I believe The Seventh Sign, which you just talked about last week. So a lot of people we lost, which is kind of a bummer. And we, you know, Elric's not here, so we can't really do an appropriate George tribute until all four of us are present. But rest assured, we're going to figure out the ideal time to do it, and we will do it before the year's out.
Yeah.
Because it's George, and he obviously deserves a full episode.
Yeah, I think we need a Romero episode in there.
So, all right, so that's that. So tell me about Canada.
So, yeah, we went to the Fantasia Film Festival. Ryan and I went. This is my second year going to Fantasia.
Okay.
And Fantasia is absolutely amazing because it's just two solid weeks of movies. And it's not just horror. So some of the stuff I'll be talking about, I'll call fringy horror because it definitely goes horror, science fiction, fantasy. There's a lot of animation. And then there's just some really fucking weird shit that I don't even know what I would classify it as. It's just like some weird stuff in there. And every year I go there and I always go with like a list of what I want to see. Mm-hmm. And then I always end up seeing other stuff and finding like gems that I absolutely love more than anything.
How much do they overlap? Are multiple movies playing like at the same time?
No, and that's a problem. Like I really wanted to see Atomic Blonde, but it had already played by the time I got there. Right. I really wanted to see Graham Skipper's film Sequence Break, our plane was delayed 4 hours, so we literally missed it because our plane got in late. So they tend to only play once, but they do have this wonderful thing that I use. It's pretty much where I live through the entire week I'm there. They have the screening room. And if you're press or in any way with the industry, you can go into the screening room, and the majority of the films that are playing in the festival are also in the screening room.
Okay.
And it looks like a voting booth where like you go in and you're kind of like there in a chair by yourself with a screen right in front of you. And then you literally just sit down and watch movies, and you have a huge selection. Like most of the stuff in the festival is there.
Wow.
And so it's really cool. And then you can also get screeners for some of the other ones that they have. So even though that not everything was playing while I was there, I was still able to see a good portion of them. And I still actually have some more to watch back at the house. So I'm excited because it's like the festival continues when I get home.
What were the standouts? I'm sure Ryan has his own, but...
The big standouts for me, again, not what I was expecting. My favorite film of the festival, and Elric is going to love this one, was this one called November. Mm-hmm. And it's based on an Estonian short story, which I was not even aware that there was a big Estonian publishing world, but I need to investigate that now. The whole concept of it is it's set in this... I want to say medieval, I'll go more like dark times, pagan village. And it focuses on these two young girls. And the town is just like, everything's real. There's werewolves, there's witches, there's God and the devil. And it's like, everything is real. But then they also, everyone steals from everybody else. It's like the most immoral kind of dark timesy place ever. But then they also have these creatures called crates walking around. And they're kind of like just these bewitched creatures constructed out of just like farm equipment and stuff they have laying around, and they're horrifying. But it's really just this dark folklorish tale done entirely in black and white, and it's just kind of like if all monsters were real.
Is it a foreign film?
It is.
Okay.
It is. And it feels very Wicker Man-ish. It feels very folklore horror. And it ended up being one of my favorite films of the festival, which I was not expecting it to be. It looked, when I was going in, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this, but I ended up really, really liking it.
November, on my list.
And most of these films do not have distribution plans yet, or if they do, they haven't announced like when it will be coming yet. So unfortunately, I don't know when you'll be able to see November, but whenever it is made available, we'll be sure to tell you, and definitely keep
Dieter
it on
Lasers
your
list. In it from The Human Centipede, according to the IMDb.
Wow. Yeah. If it is, it did not look like him.
He played Baron. Is this correct?
Yeah. That was one of the more major characters. So
yes. Maybe he's unrecognizable now. Who knows?
I would think so. Everyone was very dirty in the film too. It was kind of a grimy film.
Okay.
So there's that one. That is November. Another one that really surprised me was this documentary called Deliver Us. Hmm. And it's Italian. And when I saw the trailer and the preview for it, it looked like a documentary on a real exorcism. And so I literally went in with, well, this might be cool to cover on the site, because we do a lot of like real, I put in quotes, real kind of horror stuff on the website. And so I went in and I was like, it's a documentary on an exorcism. I'll watch it. It'll be cool to cover for the site. And it is not a documentary on a real exorcism. It falls more in line with The Keepers. And so I can't call it horror, but I can call it like freaking fascinating. It focuses on an Italian church. I think it's Italian. It was a European church where they claim to practice real exorcisms. Hmm. But they do it in this kind of grandiose P.T. Barnum-esque show. And it's one of the last places on earth where they do these like performative real exorcisms in front of people. And it followed the priest around who does them. And then it followed through his performance. It followed three people who were going in to have an exorcism done. And so it was a lot less of like a, hey, this is a real exorcism, and a lot more of a look at how the church handles mental issues and kind of the line between faith and reality. And so it was. It just ended up being one of my favorites.
It's really cool. Legit documentary.
Legit documentary, straight up.
Okay.
I think it's
called Liberanos. In Italian, but yeah, it translates to Deliver Us.
Okay. And it was a female filmmaker, which I also found fascinating, just because it was an interesting approach to the subject matter. Like, the camera stayed further back than I would have expected. And then at the end, I was like, I'm interested in how the gender would have played a role into this. So horror ones. Okay. This one was a little offbeat.
Bring on the goods. Come on.
The Laplace's Demon.
The what?
The Laplace's Demon. Okay, so the setup for this. This is Mexican. This one was Italian. A lot of these are foreign films. The Laplace's Demon, Italian film. It took the guy like 6-7 years to make this movie.
Oh.
And you see it and you're like, oh, I see why. So the whole setup is that these people have been researching if it's possible to predict the future based on science. Like, if you know the strength of a glass and how fast you throw it against the wall, can you predict how many pieces it will break into? And so it then gets, they all end up trapped in a room. I won't blow up how that happens, but they all end up trapped in a room with a mysterious kind of saw-like jigsaw person who is claiming that he has predicted everything that they will do throughout the night based on this formula.
Wow.
And that he's going to start killing them one at a time. And it's weird, and it feels like a Twilight Zone episode, and it's black and white, and at times it gets almost kind of Twilight Zone silly, but I still really liked this film. It was stylish, and I really liked the mystery behind trying to figure out how he was doing it, why he was doing it, and who was going to die next, and how they would try to get out of it. So I really, really liked that one.
That sounds fun. Silly. When you say silly, do you mean like funny, like played for laughs, or is it just like the whole kind of sheer ridiculousness of what they're trying to figure out?
Kind of the ridiculousness of the situation and what they're trying to figure out. I compared it to when I was describing it to someone else. Have you seen the Twilight Zone episode, The Invaders? Where it's, I think it's Agnes Moorehead, and she's fighting these robots, but they're literally like knee high, but they're presented as like terrifying in the episode. It's kind of that where you're like, if this came at me in any other situation, I would be like, really? Kind of that's where we're going with this. But in it, it works. It
wow.
works like a Twilight Zone episode. So that was pretty fascinating.
All right.
Game of Death.
Laplace's Demon.
Laplace's Demon.
Alrighty.
Game of Death was by far the goriest one I saw there. It is a group of the most horrible young adults ever in the entire world are hanging at this guy's grandfather's house doing drugs and having sex and drinking a lot. And they find this game in the closet called the Game of Death. And they all decide to start playing it. And it is this kind of automated 1980s game. And the game literally says, you need to kill 24 people or I will start killing one of you every 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And they don't believe it, and they go back to like doing bong hits and swimming, and then one of their head explodes. And then by the time the second person's head explodes, they realize that it's the game and it's real. So then they have to go about trying to negotiate who they're going to kill. Like, if literally you were told you have like an hour to kill 24 people, what would you do? And so it's this group of absolutely horrible people now are stuck in this situation, knowing that if they don't kill somebody, their heads will explode.
All right. To clarify, because I'm looking this up as you speak about it, mm-hmm. it's not just people we're talking about. It's millennials.
Yes. And I don't just mean millennials are horrible. These are truly the most horrible people. They go out of their way. Because when the first head explodes, you're kind of like, yes, that was awesome. And then the second one, and you're like, yes, take these horrible people down. And then it starts getting kind of, you know, they have
so
changes of heart.
It's really seven millennials who are playing the Game of Death.
Yeah.
And also, if I'm not mistaken, it looks like it says here the running time is 73 minutes. So
I am
A-okay with that.
Yeah, it was brisk. And it definitely had a couple of beat changes. Like, it began really fun, and it wasn't quite that fun and kind of splattery the whole way through. It definitely got darker as you kind of see the repercussions of everything that's going on. But it was an interesting one.
And this is in English. It's not a foreign
film? No, this is an English one. Yeah. And I will take five and let you talk for a little bit.
Holy smokes, right? Well, let's see. Let's talk about Comic-Con really quick. I did not go to Comic-Con, but the thing that I love about Comic-Con weekend is like all the studios kind of go all out in terms of look, it's a big promotional thing. Mm-hmm. They hype it up, they promote it, they get stuff out there. It's
crazy
mostly
panels.
All about the trailers and the panels and all that kind of stuff. And while for the most part I'm on top of the superhero stuff because I love seeing the new Thor and the new Justice League trailer and all that, to me the winner of Comic-Con, I'm saying it now, and I know this is bold, but I thought the trailer to Stranger Things 2 is already my favorite film of the year.
I've watched it so many times.
I know, right? Like, as soon as I finish watching it, the usage of Michael Jackson's Thriller is so goddamn good. And like every moment, it's just 3 minutes of joy to me. It hits every one of my sweet spots of everything I loved growing up. And whoever edited that trailer, you know, God, bless you, seriously. Mm-hmm. Hats off. It's one of the best trailers I've seen in a long time. And I know people are adverse to trailers, but I strongly recommend you watch this one, especially if you have any doubt that the new Stranger Things is going to be awesome. It was hilarious. I was catching up with Neil Marshall via email, and we were both talking about how we just can't stop watching it. And I laughed because he's like, it's the best usage of Thriller since, well, Thriller. And I'm like, totally agreed. It's never been used as well since the original video.
It definitely made it all the way to Fantasia because I was in the press office that they have there when it posted. And all of a sudden you just hear, it was like a chill in the room or a quiet. Ooh. And everybody was like, Stranger Things 2 just posted. And everybody gathered around one person's laptop and we were all watching it, just gasping. And it was wonderful.
Yeah, I can't stop watching it. It's such a good trailer and I keep watching it. The other one I'm intrigued about, I don't know if it debuted at Comic-Con or if it was just the timing was the day or two before, but we finally got the first trailer to the new Saw movie, which I keep forgetting exists.
Yeah, it's coming in October.
Yeah, like literally right at the last weekend of October, and it's called Jigsaw as opposed to Saw Legacy, which was the original title. And, you know, it looks kind of okay.
It looks fun. Like, I definitely lost interest in the Saw films towards the end.
Yeah.
But I saw this and was kind of like, you know what? I'm ready to try this again.
Yeah, so. I think so. I think it's been enough time. And I also like that they are just, the trailer is pretty much what you as a fan watching it would expect, which mm-hmm. is like, how can there be another Jigsaw killer? Or like, you know, he died all those years ago. Sorry, spoiler alert, but he hasn't been in the franchise for a long time. And so they're like, is it a copycat or is it, what is going on here? And it just looks like they really went overboard with the intricate traps. Mm-hmm. So it just looks, yeah, it actually looks like a lot of fun. And, you know, between that and the Leatherface is coming out around the same time, that one's going to be a direct to, I think it's direct TV and then it's VOD, but, October is going to be pretty like jam packed, a lot of new stuff. So I'm pretty excited that we're getting this burst of horror towards the second half of the year.
Now, what did you think of the trailer for Shape of Water? Cause I about cried in the airport watching that.
Oh
thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot Shape of Water. So it's the new, Guillermo del Toro movie. You know what I like about this is I knew nothing about it. I didn't know it was coming. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it existed. It's like Del Toro, bless him, I love Del Toro, but he's been attached to so many projects that just never happen that you kind of like give up hope. Like, oh, I guess we're never going to see that Lovecraft movie wants to make.
Yeah.
So this just came as such a pleasant surprise and it's great. I mean, it honestly looks like his version of Creature from the Black Lagoon, mm-hmm. which is not far-fetched because I know he wanted to remake that for a long time. And I just love that filmmakers are like, screw it. If we can't remake that property, let's just do our version of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the famous story is that George Lucas wanted to do, I think he wanted to do Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers. Mm-hmm. He wanted to do one of those famous serials as a big movie. Couldn't get the rights, created Star Wars. And now we have Star Wars. So
it works.
So that's the thing. It's like, if you can't remake that property, you don't have to remake it. Just do your own thing. That's why I love Stranger Things. I mean, a lot of people knock on it. Like, I just, what are you, adverse to joy?
Yeah.
Are you adverse to all the things we loved growing up? Like, it's just a callback to that. And it's done with respect. So I'm all for it. I think this, you know, it looks like everything that Del Toro has perfected in all his movies, like all the, he's had such grace going from, you know, both the supernatural to monsters to the sympathetic love story. And it looks like it has all that in mm-hmm. there. So
it looked like it had that fairy tale element too. Just, yeah.
Yeah. He gets better and better each movie. And although Crimson Peak, I'd love to revisit it because I had a lot of mixed feelings about it. I think this one is definitely more in line with what I would expect from him. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else can I talk about? Well, we'll have to bug Ryan because we had Blumhouse Productions announced they were doing Spawn.
Yeah.
Which came out of nowhere, and I was totally shocked by that.
And McFarlane's directing.
Tom McFarlane, get out of here. This is me. He was one of my heroes growing up.
Yeah.
Because I was a big Spider-Man guy, and then Image Comics, obviously, so.
I had every one of those toys.
Yeah.
Like, that was the movie maniacs were, like, everything to me in college, like, lined my shelves.
He's the first one that gave us action figures of movie maniacs, because it was, like, before that, you could never buy a freaking, like, action figure of a horror icon.
Yeah.
And then that was a big deal. I remember when the first line of Movie Maniacs came out. So
I had the variants. I was like Maniacs geeky.
So yes, I mean, I have nothing but love and respect for Todd McFarlane. I think that's super cool. So I hope that means we get to meet him at some point.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
One thing I wanted to plug, only because I think it's so cool. Everyone knows how much I love vinyl, especially horror soundtrack vinyl and just vinyl in general. And both Ryan and I are big fans of Waxwork Records and what they do. They're one of the great, great labels out there, and I usually buy directly from them. They have been planning this for, I think, over a year now, and they just released a comic book called House of Waxwork. And I just got this thing in the mail, and I just love it because it's a comic book that's in the Creepshow variety where there's a kind of a Crypt Keeper style host called the Director.
Wow.
He's hilarious. And there's two stories in there. But what's cool about it is every issue, it comes with a 7-inch. So there's music that accompanies each story. It's only two stories.
Wow.
So the 7-inch has a theme, which was Douglas Pipes, who does all of Michael Dougherty's movies. He did the Trick or Treat score and he did the theme for this. And then, you know what it is? I love and advocate kind of the having an immersive experience of this sort. So literally you drop the needle down, you put the song on, each track is about 6 minutes long, which is how long it takes me to read the story.
So you read it
you're literally getting a 6-minute soundtrack while you read the story. And I didn't notice this until I posted a photo of it, but this is what the director looks like on the cover of House of Waxwork.
Oh my gosh, he's beautiful.
Somebody said to me, he's like, is that supposed to be David Lynch?
And I'm Holy shit, it is.
Maybe it is. He does look kind of like he's got Lynchian hair.
He's got very Lynchian hair,
but,
and down to the bow tie too.
Yeah, this thing is great. And I was, you know, when they were showing like little video clips of like Douglas Pipes with a full orchestra recording the theme, I was nervous that this thing was going to be ridiculously expensive. I was like, oh my God, a 7-inch comic book, this is going to cost so much money. It's $15.
Oh my gosh.
It's not bad. It's totally worth it. There's, I think, two different variants in terms of like the colored vinyl that you can get with it. And I hope it's a success because I love cool shit like this. And that's the thing is at this point we're inundated with so much stuff, vinyl, Blu-rays, t-shirts, soundtracks, enamel pins. It's like a horror fan's wet dream right now. And getting cool, different stuff like this that combines them, I just think is awesome. So hats off to Waxworks. And if you haven't, go to their website and check out the comic book. I think it's great.
That's terrific. I'll plug a couple more films that I saw while I was there.
Yeah.
And speaking of cool stuff, I will discuss my cool find that I found. So we left the area that's like directly around Fantasia because my daughter was very insistent that she had to have a stuffed dinosaur.
And, naturally.
My daughter really likes dinosaurs. And the area surrounding Fantasia, because it's at a university, it's like bars and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, we'll walk like 10 minutes to find a toy shop. And on the way, I found this really punk rock store. And so we were looking through t-shirts there and it was like Dead Kennedys and, you know, all the standard kind of punk rocky t-shirts. And they had all these horror shirts mixed in, but they were strange horror shirts, like Return of the Living Dead Part 3.
Yeah. You were sending us photos of them.
Yeah, I was sending, and it's like these movies that I've never seen t-shirts of. I ended up coming home with a Return of the Living Dead t-shirt, but it is the Thai movie poster.
Oh.
And so it's this artwork I've never seen before, but I'm totally psyched and have to wear the t-shirt to the show one night so I can show you guys. It's really cool looking.
Excellent.
Yeah, so that was definitely like my literally kind of wandered into this store and was pleasantly surprised.
I love that when you're on a trip and you find cool goodies like that.
Yeah, we went in because looked like there was this punk rock store called Search and Destroy we used to go into in New York all the time, and it looked like that. So I was like, let's go in. And it was awesome find. So a couple more films to definitely keep an eye out for. Love and Other Cults. Rob, you will like this one.
Oh.
This is a Japanese film and...
Sold.
Yeah. It's a group of teen boys wander into this bathroom and on the wall it says...
No, wait. Maybe I'm not sold. Continue.
It says something like, for a good time or if you would like to have sex, please call. And it's got this number.
All right. I'm back
and
on.
And so the boys are like, you know what? Let's call it. So they call. And this girl shows up, but she shows up with this pimp and these gangsters, and they end up extorting a lot of money out of these boys. And then right as they're like leading this girl, no sex, right as they're leading this girl back away, she turns around and she whispers at one of the boys, help me.
Oh,
and
wow.
So this is like a crazy setup for a movie right there. And as I was looking back at it, I'm like, that is the setup for like an action film, like a crazy night adventure action film of like what they did to go help this girl who's clearly being held captive. But it doesn't turn into that. It somehow becomes more like, how would I call it? Like a suburban teen kind of angsty movie, but it's also hilarious. Something like Suburbia or SLC Punk,
uh-huh.
Something in that vein, but it's all about being held captive at the same time. So it's very kind of Japanese in that vein that it is mixing this like incredibly heavy subject matter, but making it kind of hilarious and dark all at the same time. The movie had a lot going for it.
So it's crazy and like culty rather than traditional horror.
Yes.
Right. And you wrote about this on the site.
I did. Yeah. I did an article about this yesterday. So yeah, that was Love and Other Cults. If you're looking for something a little offbeat, this was definitely a cool find of the festival. And then I saw King Cohen.
Oh my God. Yes. I've been dying. I can't wait. And this is, of course, the documentary about Larry Cohen.
Yes. And the viewing experience alone was epic because they had this in one of the larger theaters and it was a complete and total packed house, like completely full. And Michael Moriarty came and did his intro and spoke and then presented Larry Cohen with the Lifetime Achievement Award and everything. And just listening to Michael Moriarty tell stories about Larry Cohen was amazing. And then Larry Cohen hops up and tells stories about Michael Moriarty. And
love
the two of them, I mean, they've done like four or five films together. So just watching the two of them work together and how they interact and everything was absolutely amazing. And Ryan just jumped in
Holy
and is joining
oh
us.
Oh my God.
And Ryan sat next to me during the screening. So I'm talking about King Cohen.
This is just a
there he is.
A knockout episode, guys.
Oh my God. It's a guest appearance by Ryan Turek. Here we are.
I'm sorry. We're
just wrapping up Fantasia Talk, but she just got to King Cohen, which I'm very excited about.
Cohen's great. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
I was in it.
It goes, Ryan's in it. He's talking head.
Well, because, you are a talking head in it. I thought it was because of the jump cut stuff too, right?
No. I'm actually, they interviewed me about 2 years ago for it, just because I'm a big Larry Cohen fan because of Q and the stuff.
You talk about God Told Me To.
I talk about God Told Me To, and they even got some quotes from Salem's Lot, the Salem's Lot sequel.
Oh, wow.
I know. I was like, wow, they use a lot of my sound bites for the Salem's Lot sequel.
Salem's Lot. Ryan comes across as a really big Salem's Lot sequel fan.
Are you?
No.
I was going to say, wait. God, no. That sounds like some manipulation in editing there. God.
But one of the most powerful moments, and this was just for me personally, of it. They go film by film through Larry Cohen's whole history, talk about how he came up in the film world and kind of his on-set persona, which is very kind of run and gun, no permits, just fucking get the shot type directing. But as the film progressed, they talked about what he was doing now, and they showed footage from a script reading that we did at Jump Cut 2 years ago.
Yeah, Alric's Cafe, for those that are new to this episode. Mm-hmm.
And sitting in the audience, I could see myself there. You know, it was just like the whole gang was there, and then standing right behind Larry the whole time was Alric.
Oh,
and
man.
So it was wonderful. In his velvet jacket that he always wore for screenings there.
Well, what's great is that there is this kind of two-shot of Larry in the foreground profile shot of Larry looking at the screen, and then in the background out of focus is Elric, but it's clearly Elric, but it's kind of like this beautifully stacked two-shot profile shot of the two of them together, and I was like, oh,
I teared up like as soon as it started. I was like, oh,
I look
man.
Forward to seeing a lot of out of focus Elric in this King Cohen documentary. It's gonna be amazing. And by the way, he was Larry Cohen was on Shockwaves way back on episode 18, which is one of my favorite episodes because he's just such a great storyteller and had a lot of fun things to say. But
apparently he does an amazing Ed Wynn impression. Oh. So next time we have him on, we have to ask him to do that.
Cool. So this was the premiere of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, cool. I can't wait for this to come out.
And I believe it's got a couple other festivals lined up, mm-hmm. so people will be able to check it out. But it doesn't have a buyer right now. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, cool. I can't wait to see it.
It's for sale.
So no word yet on when everybody can see it, but it is doing a couple more festivals. Yeah. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Wow. What about you, Ryan, since you're jumping in here? You want to talk Fantasia a little bit?
I'm sorry. No, not so much Fantasia.
Oh, okay. What do you got? What do you got for us?
What had happened at Fantasia?
Oh, because you were part of it.
I was part of the film market. So my job was to sit there for 3 days and listen to pitches and talk to potential filmmakers and producers about.
Sounds like a blast.
Yeah, it is actually. It is fun. But the problem is that they stack your schedule so much that you don't actually get to see anything.
Oh.
So the two things I got to see were this Canadian horror film with Lauren Holly called Dead Shack. And there's not much to say about that. And then Larry Cohen documentary, which we just covered. But it's been a lot of traveling this week for work. And not this week, this month. So it's been just catching up on things that I haven't seen, like Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2.
You were very excited last episode to discover this on Amazon
Prime. Did you love it?
I absolutely adored it.
The rocking horse
is insane. The rocking horse is so fucking like perverse and weird. And when he like the father comes into the room, and I'm like talking and spoiling things, but I think Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2, everybody's like, oh, it's better than the first film. I don't know about that, but I really
like.
They're
very different.
They're very different films, exactly. I think Prom Night 1 serves its purpose. Prom Night 2 is a little bit more wacky and supernatural and Carrie-esque. But the thing about it is it's got a lot of great death blows.
Yeah.
You know, from the locker crushing scene to
it's great.
You know, the there's just like a lot of great stuff. But the one thing that really stood out for me was the chalkboard sequence.
Oh, does it get all watery or
something walks,
like that?
Yeah. Our protagonist walks up to a chalkboard. And it's when she gets possessed. Mm. And she walks up to the chalkboard and all of a sudden she turns around and these two hands come out of the chalkboard and pull our protagonist into the chalkboard and she's swimming in it. Yeah, and it's like all black and, you know, milky, black and like gooey and all that stuff. And then the letters that were written in chalk on the blackboard before she got sucked in start floating across the thing.
Yeah, I need to remember that. This movie.
It is really, really impressive.
Yeah. I remember thinking that was all Nightmare on Elm Street. Like the franchise was so big at that point that I felt like they were trying to do these surreal, absolutely. Weird, nightmare-esque sequences.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that was really, really especially cool. And it's a nasty little movie. There's a really sharp edge to it that that cuts deep, and that's good. It's really, really cool.
How'd the version on Amazon Prime look?
Looked okay. Yeah, it just looked okay. What was the other film that
needs
I saw
a good
on
release? And it's only been on DVD, and
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
It's definitely one that hasn't gotten a lot of love, but it should.
Yeah.
While Ryan's thinking of his other film, I visited My Little Eye again, which I had.
Oh, My Little Eye.
My Little Eye. I had not seen this one
with Bradley Cooper,
a very young. He comes out of the woods, and you're like, "My, you're handsome!" Like he's literally been lost in the wood for 3 days. Shows up at this house and you're like, you look so handsome, sir.
Yeah.
But this is from 2002 and it really does feel like a love letter to Big Brother, but also kind of like you can feel where Saw was kind of winding up in this whole kind of filmmaking world of the time. It's a group of people who are living in this house for like one full year. I think it's like, it might be like 10 months, but it's a long stretch and they have to stay in this house. It's very isolated, rural. They cannot leave the property. If one of them leaves, no one gets the money. If they all stay, they each get like $1 million. And they're there under the idea that all of their actions, everything from when they go to the bathroom to when they sleep, is being recorded on webcams. Mm-hmm. And so the whole house is outfitted in these webcams everywhere, and it's recording everything that they are doing. And so they, the film picks up right at the end of their stay. Like they literally have like 3 days left. And they get to leave and they know nothing because they've been completely separated from the outside world. So they know nothing. They just know that they have been here for a year in this single house. And every couple of days, a box of food gets delivered on the outskirts of the property. They don't even know who delivers it. And then all of a sudden, Bradley Cooper shows up.
Mm.
And then, you know, the whole thing kind of starts unraveling.
Shit hits the fan.
It's it's weird watching
back
it now.
Back before that meant something. Bradley
yeah,
Cooper
before that meant something.
Who's that guy? Now you're like, oh, it's Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper. But at the time, everybody was like, who the fuck's that guy?
Yeah. I mean, he puts some moves on him.
Yeah,
on
he nails one of them.
Heck yeah.
No, I was just going to be like, doesn't he bang one of the girls? And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to be respectful. And then
Becca
just say what's on their mind.
That is the plot point because it is the most like, obviously, like, I am here to have sex with this girl. And then at the end of it, and this is not blowing plot, he literally looks into the camera and says, told you I could bang her. And that's that's when you're suddenly like, oh shit, something's going on.
Yeah.
It's like, and that's, it doesn't blow the reveal by any means.
So
that's kind of like,
this movie falls in line with, there's a kind of experiment that I want to play where I've only seen this film once, but it really stuck with me. And there's something I've been wanting to do, which is revisit films from the early 2000s that I've only seen once and just see like, years later, how they hold up. Hollow Man is one of those. This movie is one of those, you know?
This one is a little unusual. There's an article on it on the site where when I first saw it, this was one of the first examples of digital filmmaking. One of the first major movies, and this wasn't even a major movie, it's an indie film, that was made with a digital camera. And they do it because the majority of the film is meant to look like a webcam. And when I first saw this movie, I remember finding it so uncomfortable, like it was difficult for me to watch it because of the digital filmmaking. And now I was like, oh, this feels great. Like it didn't, if anything, it felt low quality.
Like your mind and your eyes have acclimated to the style.
Adapted.
Right.
So yeah, but I remember at the time that was the only thing that was really off-putting is everything felt like it was moving funky. And now I was like, if anything, it felt lo-fi.
Wasn't that film My Little Eye paired with, like, in terms of the pushing boundaries of shooting on digital, what's the other one? Series 7? Do you remember Series 7?
Oh, I love that movie.
I don't.
Yeah. You should check it out. Series 7 was another kind of one of those kind of webcam movies.
It was a reality sort of, it was a show. It starred the girl that's in the pit in Silence of the Lambs as the lead,
who
popped up in the final season. Brooke Smith, who's in the final season of Bates Motel.
Yes.
And excellent in it. But she stars in it. It's kind of like, it's presented as a reality TV show.
It's a reality TV show and everybody's asked to kill one another.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
It's called Series 7. Series 7, The Contenders.
That's it.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one in forever. That was really good. I remember they used a lot of Joy Division and that made me happy.
Yes. I may have the video of that still because I remember, because around that time also Fangoria did a movie called Slashers.
Yep.
Which was like a Japanese like game show.
Yeah, like a Running Man.
You have to survive against these freaking lunatics.
It was Running Man.
By the way, My Little Eye, it's got a quote on the box that says, from the face or the fact, the greatest fright flick since The Exorcist.
Oh.
So there you go. Mighty high praise from the face.
I will say, it's tense. Like,
come on, Becca. Like The Exorcist?
No, not The Exorcist level by any
Exorcist?
Means.
Okay.
But it definitely, this is one that it held up for me, where I was still just like, I forgot what happened, and I'm just as riveted as I was the first time.
Excellent.
All righty. Nice. I got a couple of films. Do you have any more left, Ryan? Hello, Mary Lou, Prom Night 2.
I do. But why don't you take a crack at one?
Yeah, I'll be quick with these. I just wanted to mention Deathline because last week we had Gary Sherman on and I drove him to the screening immediately after. And I got to tell you, it was a lot of fun. The movie's great. I advocate this Blue Underground Blu-ray of it. They showed the Blu-ray was the 4K scan that they used for the Blu-ray. So it was a digital DCP of it. Movie looks amazing. I thought, Donald Pleasance is really funny. He thinks he's in a comedy, or at least as now that he explained that to us, it's kind of fun. And it also has the great that when we're first introduced to the cannibal guy, who lives under the subway.
The man.
The man as he's credited. It is this gorgeous one take 7-minute tracking shot, and just seeing it on the big screen and seeing it the way it was.
It's when the camera rotates around his den,
Through the den.
Starts on the arm.
Yep, and then it goes through these bodies, and then you see like another, like somebody, the most recent victim, and then you see his like wife in bed, and it just goes around the whole room, and it's really just there's stuff like that in this movie that make it like special, and so it was a lot of fun. I mean, honestly, to well, it's not really bragging. It's just, it's the fun of seeing a movie like this here in Los Angeles is, Gary was sitting in front of me next to Bill Lustig. And then two seats behind me was Bob Murawski, who runs Grindhouse Releasing. Right. And then David Gregory from Severn Films. It was like everybody that puts movies out was there.
Right.
Ewan Kant, who works for Arrow Films, was in town.
Yep.
So everyone was there. And I was surprised to see Jordan Ladd of Cabin Fever fame.
Huh.
But that's because her dad is the lead of the movie.
Oh my God, that's her dad?
Yeah, so then he got up and did the Q&A. And I was like, oh, lad, it's, oh my God, it's her dad.
Holy shit.
So that is her dad in that movie. So they were all there. They were all there, and it was a lot of fun to see it that way.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was super cool. So that's already on Blu-ray right now, Deathline. And really quickly, since we're talking Blue Underground, they also just released the Stendhal Syndrome
on
Blu-ray.
I just got my copy of. I don't think I've ever seen this.
You know what? I thought I did too, but I didn't. When I saw bits of it, but when I watched it this go around, I was like, I've definitely never seen this movie. It's an entire.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because the second half, I was like, what is this?
I swear I've seen it before, but once I read the back of it, I was like, I've never seen this.
Yeah, it's a pretty. You know what? It's actually pretty good.
Yeah.
But the Blu-ray is amazing. And the thing is, there is some stuff that Argento does in this movie that is top of his game, Argento. Like there's a sequence where Asia, his daughter, is the lead of this and she's kind of like a detective, but she's got like this sort of obsession / weird relationship with some serial killer guy, like the serial rapist killer. It gets really awkward knowing that it's Dario and he's directing his daughter who's doing these things on screen for probably the first time.
It was a conversation starter after this film because it's like
that continued a bit in some of the future films.
What he does to her on film.
Oh God. Yeah.
But there's sequences where she's staring into like this beautiful like blue painting and then she kind of passes out and like pans into the painting and now we're underwater with all these fish and like Ozzy's like swimming in the water and you're like, this is like gorgeous and amazing. And then juxtapose, there's two or three of the worst early CG shots ever done. Like there's a part where she takes like some pills. I don't know if it's aspirin or whatever. And we get a CG shot of the pills going down her esophagus.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like,
is it CG or is it just really?
It's just really bad, like computer graphics sort of thing. So it's a little weird because the movie's fully restored and like 90% of it looks amazing. And then you get one or two shots like that. They're like, oh, why?
That's just so weird. I don't remember that. I always remember it being practical because our Dario would love those like close up shots, going inside the body. And
there's
two
or three very noticeable shots like that again, it's like some of his best stuff and some of his worst on one movie. And the thing is this, it's a little long. It's about 2 hours. It hovers on the 2 hour mark. And the second hour is like a completely different movie, but it's still kind of interesting and fun. And I think it's pretty decent Argento. And it's 3-disc Blu-ray. Fantastic. Brand new interview with Asia. She looks freaking amazing. Better than she ever's looked. And she does the whole interview in Italian, subtitled, of course. And a lot of fun stuff. She said this was originally set up as an American movie with Bridget Fonda in her role.
Wow.
And can you freaking imagine? And it fell apart. Dario got frustrated. He's like, screw it. I'll just do it. You're going to be in it.
Yeah.
And that's how it came together.
Well,
but
maybe it was all the rape that sent
them maybe
packing, I just got that Blu-ray this week, and I can't wait to dig into it.
Yeah, the Stendhal Syndrome.
Nice. The other things that I had watched this week while I was bound to my hotel room, I revisited Grindhouse, both Death Proof and Planet Terror because—
As Grindhouse, the full—
No,
separately?
I just call it Grindhouse just because, I don't know, that's what they are.
Well, that version's available on Blu-ray.
And because Shudder has it.
Cool.
They're on Shudder in Canada.
Oh.
And they don't have the wine scenes, the opening credits, it's all a little different just because it's a distributor in Canada,
so
they were able to strike a deal up there. The movies kind of hold up well.
Yeah.
I enjoy, and I think nothing has really changed except for my hate-love relationship with Death Proof.
Me too.
I feel like Planet Terror still holds up really well. It's just like a big goofy blast.
Yep.
It still cracks me up. A lot of the gore gags still, freak me out. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, this is great.
Jeff Fahey. And Michael Biehn, his
Jeff
brothers,
Fahey.
Is so good.
Yeah. Jeff Fahey and Michael Biehn, kind of working on the dynamic they have in which they're like just trying to figure out who's got the better barbecue sauce.
Right. And I love
Michael
Biehn's
really really jealous.
He's always proud of him to tell him the secret. Yeah, I love it.
What cracks me up is like he Michael Biehn calls Jeff Fahey about some work stuff, and then he's like, "You're going to tell me that goddamn recipe." And he's like, "Not in your life." Hang up. He hangs up on him.
I need to rewatch this.
It's a lot of fun.
It's really fun. Memories of this.
It's good. It's just a good time. Death Proof. You know, it's funny, man, because I threw on Death Proof. I had jet lag, and I was like, I'm going to throw this on because I know it'll put me out. And I wound up watching all 2 hours of it. Mm. And, you know, it's a little inside baseball, which is, I feel like, is the reason why I think a lot of people are isolated from it, because all you have is like, well, the first half is not so inside baseball. The first half you have Kurt Russell targeting, a bunch of these gals at the bar. And
then
the second half, you've got Kurt Russell basically targeting a bunch of people that work, a bunch of stunt women who work in film. And all they're doing is talking about inside baseball movie stuff.
You know,
oh, who did the grip sleep with? Who did this? And it was like, no one cares about, no one like can identify with that really. But the rewards are so great because by the time the big chase happens at the end, it is really magnificent. It feels dangerous. There's a great sense of propulsion. There's a lot of great stunts. I just thought if you hang in there through that kind of, not so much the first half when you've got Stuntman Mike and Rose McGowan bantering with one another. All that stuff is fun and enjoyable and engaging. But once you get to the stunt women and all their gossip talk, you just kind of like tune out.
Yeah.
And then once they get to the car, then you're like, okay, I'm back in, you know?
That's why I like the shorter version better, the one that's part of the Grindhouse as a feature. And I agree with you 100%. I think it's an okay movie.
Yeah.
It's probably
it's low on the list of Tarantino.
But that 20 or so minutes of that car chase is exceptional filmmaking because it's all practical. Mm-hmm. Zoe Bell's on that car the entire time. And a lot of people don't realize Tarantino ran camera, so he's there too. This is the one movie he shot himself. And that stuff is just terrific filmmaking.
Yeah, it's insane. And then the other thing I was telling you before we hopped on the show, Willard was like $7.99 on iTunes, so I just picked it up.
This is the remake. Okay.
Remake by Glenn Morgan, written by Glenn Morgan, who was part of Glenn Morgan and James Wong. One of those kind of late aughts horror movies when everything was being remade and Glenn Morgan was like, oh, I'm going to do Willard. Why not? Crispin Glover, R. Lee Ermey, and a lot of CGI rats. But the rats that they do have that are practical are adorable. It's a weird fucking movie, man. It's got this kind of atmosphere to it that is obviously they shot it in Canada, but it has this kind of just on the outskirts suburban New York thing just outside Manhattan where it's like it's not Manhattan proper, but it's just like maybe up north a little bit in suburbia. Uh-huh. So everything looks dour. Everything looks kind of like it's just dripping with kind of fall wet atmosphere and autumn hues. And that stuff is all really cool. It's shot beautifully. Shirley Walker does a score. The late Shirley Walker did the score for it and did a fantastic theme for it. It just feels like a stack of scenes, like a stack of just kooky scenes with Crispin Glover interacting with rats. They try to kind of drive it along with this kind of emotional thing where Crispin Glover is obviously emotionally isolated from his mother who has passed away. R. Lee Ermey wants to fire him, but he's got a coworker that kind of likes him, but all he can do is find friendship in his rats, his rat pals.
That's all from the original.
And then what happens is like he sets out for revenge on R. Lee Ermey. But everything like, it's just it's a weirdly paced movie. Very, very strange where it's just like Crispin Glover sitting in a chair with a newspaper and he's whacking the side of the armchair with this newspaper and then the rat, Socrates, his favorite rat, comes up and starts chewing on it. And he's like, yeah, tear it.
Chew.
Tear it up.
Chew.
Chew.
Cut.
Tear it.
Cut.
But then the next thing you know, we break into like a fucking montage of like him training the rats.
Yeah, like eat the tire.
Yeah, eat the tire and climb on this rope and do it. And I'm like, hold up. You just came to this decision? Like,
wow.
There was like weird motivations behind it all. But I mean, like, there's a reason why I bought it, because I just think I love its bizarre personality. And I didn't realize this until I sat through the credits. Crispin Glover sings the Ben song.
Oh, that's right.
He does the cover of the Michael Jackson song, which is hilarious.
He's Crispin Hellion Glover. He's quite Hellion a musician. Glover.
So, wow. But yeah, Willard was part of my kind of experiment to kind of revisit horror films from 2000 to like 2009 that I'd only seen like once or twice, just to kind of get a reassessment. And Willard kind of falls in this kind of check it out if you've never seen it. Yeah. And if you're a big fan of Crispin Glover, he does it. It's a really good performance out of him, but it's just a bizarre movie. And you could tell why it tanked, because like nobody wanted to see this fucking
Now it's a cult movie. Yeah.
There was that one, and right around the same time, he did a remake of Gore Gore Girls.
Wizard of Gore.
Wizard of Gore, thank
you. I like quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, I really liked his performance in that one, I remember. I haven't seen it since it came out, but I do remember that I liked the Wizard of Gore.
I don't know if he's acting in either of these
movies,
guys.
He played Montag the Magnificent.
Yes. It's wonderful.
Oh, yes.
I got one more really quick one before we wrap. I took advantage of the Scream Factory sale that they had last month. They were doing a half off on everything. Oh, yeah. And this was one of the earliest titles they put out that for whatever reason I just missed, but I picked up The Island from 1980, and this is directed by Michael Ritchie, who went on to do Fletch, The Golden Child, and The Bad News Bears.
Oh, yeah.
It was written by Peter Benchley. It's based on the book by the guy that wrote Jaws, and it stars Mr. Michael Caine. So I figured, oh, this should be fun. It's a pretty wacky movie. It starts out awesome, because basically what's happening is there's people out on the sea. And it's almost like the cast of like The Hills Have Eyes just keep jumping on the boat and like murdering them horribly. Like I think in the first 5 minutes, there's a sequence where it's like all these guys laughing and trading stories. And you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. And literally, it felt like The Burning. Like all of a sudden, you see this tattooed guy, like arm come out from a boat that's like floating beside it, and like an axe goes in a face, and then like a machete like cuts off an arm, and then all of a sudden you're at Michael Caine walking down the street, and you're like, whoa, what the hell just happened? So it starts out like that, and I'm like, if this is Hills Have Eyes on boats, I'm like so all in.
Yeah.
But then Michael Caine is in a reporter, and he goes with his son to investigate, and they get hijacked and brought back to the island where all these people are, and they're more like Road Warrior, Mad Max like types, led by David Warner. He's the leader of these people.
Holy shit.
And they're pretty much, once they're at the island, it kind of slows down a bit, and I didn't dig the movie as much, because basically they're trying to turn Michael Caine's kid against him because they don't have enough children there. So they're trying to like turn this kid into like a murderous, you know, one of like member of the clan. And then, no spoilers, obviously, but then like the last 5 or 10 minutes is so freaking bonkers that I was full in again. And I was like, this movie's awesome. So The Island from 1980, if you're looking for something just really out there, I remember Jeff Nelson from Scream Factory posted, The Island, it's no Jaws. And then I think I replied to him, so I was like, Jaws is no Peter Benchley's Jaws, because that book's not that good either.
Yeah.
But it's a wacky movie. And again, it's funny just that even from the beginning, Scream Factory is putting out some of the weirdest shit.
Yeah.
So bless them.
The Island. I have not seen that.
I haven't either.
I'll lend it to you guys, because I think you need to. Yeah. I think you need to.
Okay.
This is one of those ones that I didn't do this, but if I Instagrammed that opening moment, and you would have asked me about it. You'd be like, dude, what is that? I got to watch that.
Yeah.
It's very much like my...
I mean, like Michael Caine and David Warner, I'm already in.
Yeah, that's all you need. Yeah. It's pretty good.
Before we part, I will say that while in Canada, I decided to pick up a Blu-ray of Before I Wake.
Yes.
I had to walk off campus, and I ended up finding like a nice little music DVD store over near the University of Montreal, a little bit away.
Excellent.
But yeah, I'm really excited to check it out. And it's really ridiculous that you have to travel to another country to get it, but I'm excited to see it.
Cool. All right. Before I Wake, available in Canada.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back with our guest. Okay, and welcome back to the show. And here's a guest. We say this a lot. We said it at the top of the show. Here's a guest we've always wanted to have on.
We've definitely mentioned it.
We mean it. We truly mean it. Somebody that has a very eclectic career in the business. And ironically, as you guys know, I've worked on a lot of special features for Blu-ray stuff. Mm. I worked on so many of this guy's films, and yet I'd never gotten to actually interview him directly. Welcome to the show, Mr. Ted Raimi.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm a big fan.
Excellent. Listens every week, obviously.
I was going to say, I always like having those guests that have really long IMDb creds, and you just like, it's getting there.
I mean, I'm looking. It's
pretty long.
It is long. It's, you know, you reach a point in your career where you have done enough things and you're no longer, you know, the bright-eyed kid anymore, and you think you are.
Yeah.
Because you don't, you know, that's just the way age works. But then all of a sudden these actors come up to you and they go, oh my God, you've done this and you've done that, and I saw you in this and I saw you in that, and you go, oh, I'm the old venerated guy now. I'm not the kid. And I look around, there's like not that many people older than me, so that, you know, that sort of just happens that way.
Yeah.
And then I also look curious. I went down the list of IMDb credits, and they don't tell you they don't number them.
No.
So I had to count, you have to count them individually on IMDb.
Yeah.
So I counted them maybe 6 months ago. So I was curious, how many movies have I done?
How many are you at now?
I'm at like 94 or
okay.
something.
Oh.
That's good.
I'm at about 94 movies. Yeah, and that's what I thought. Yeah, that's cool.
That's good.
That's really, yeah, is. Yeah. And then I realized, Jesus, it takes a long effing time to get there, and that means I'm an old guy. Because you don't make 100... Sorry, can we swear on this show?
Yes. Oh, fuck
100
yes, we
fucking
can.
Movies, and that's a lot of fucking movies to make.
It is.
And I made them, you know, and those were the days too when not, you know, every kid in their garage had a video camera. I mean, it was a challenge to get into a movie. So I was pretty proud of that, you know. And they're not all great movies. I mean, a lot of them are I wish I hadn't done.
Yeah.
Well,
I was gonna say, what but with IMDb accumulated credit and age, I mean, that comes wisdom.
So you have that. That's a nice way to look at it.
That's very contentious of you, Ryan.
Are you any
you
know. Wiser from when you began?
Nope. I'm not any wiser, but I am more experienced, and that's a good thing, you know. I suppose so. Yeah, you know. Yeah.
I imagine Roger Corman wakes up every morning and goes, "Oh, let me look. Oh, 500 credits."
I need some.
I don't think so. No, Roger Corman wakes up and goes, I wonder if I can get Ted for $100 a day.
Yeah.
Ted, it's Roger. I know you've done a couple of my movies in the past, and hell, you know, we're old friends, and $100, you know, it's a hell, we'll give you free lunch. You know, I mean, that guy still makes the deals that he can make.
Yeah,
you know, he's awesome.
Does he call you personally to do the casting?
I have spoken to him on one or two occasions, yeah, when I wouldn't take $100. I was like, I ain't gonna do this movie for $100. I don't care. and then Roger calls me, Ted, it's Roger. look, also he's also a fellow Detroiter. So, I have a soft spot for Detroiters.
Right. You know, you've worked with so many amazing people, but we like to always go back to the very beginning because for us, as genre fans, we remember those early movies that had an impact on us and made us horror fans.
Yeah.
So what was it for you? What made you fall in love with film at a young age?
That's a good question. When I was very young, my parents took me to see what was it? Oh, yeah. I saw The Stuntman.
Oh,
wow. That's such a fun movie.
Yes. I saw it in the theaters when I was a kid in like 19, I think it was 79. Mm-hmm. I went to see it. My parents took me to see all the kinds of adult movies that kids shouldn't see. I saw that, and that really impressed me. And another one I saw was when I was very young, Marathon Man.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
with Dustin Hoffman. Yeah, that was, I think that was like 1976, and I was only like 11 or something. And that was really adult.
Yeah.
You know, that was like super adult. But I, those movies, you know, had a great impact on me. And then 1,000 reruns of the original Star Trek, you know.
Yeah.
I think we all have that in common, probably. Yeah. There were two things that made me really love horror and never want to leave it. And the first was some of the original, when I was really young, Night Galleries with Rod Serling, towards the end of his career in the, you know, like 74, 75. I saw those when they first aired. And they scared the crap out of me, but I thought they were so great. And the second is later, the very last gasp of the radio horror drama was on the air. And this was called the CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Interesting.
And it starred E.G. Marshall as the host. And, you know, back in, like, the 70s, chances are there were still some execs who'd been around for 20 or 30 years who thought, oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. Radio drama. Someone probably desperately tried to tell him that there had been television for 30 years at that point.
Talkies.
And that nobody was listening to those anymore. And, you know, but it ran for like 6 or 7 years. But I remember E.G. Marshall. Every Sunday night, I would go into my room, and, you know, these are the days when there was just radio. Mm. There was no podcast, of course. Mm. For those young folks listening, there was just radio. And he would say, in this great gravelly voice, and it was so awesome, he would say, "Come in." And I went, whoa, 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 whoa. And it really freaked my shit. And I thought, man, it always resonated with me. And he was over the top of what most actors would do with that. You know, he was over exaggerating that moment. And I thought, that's all I want to do. Mm-hmm. I never ever went for straight parts after that. I never wanted to do that. Even when I started acting, you know, for real, like in my early 20s, it didn't interest me. I never loved it. I never went for it. And I became a character actor, and I became a character actor in horror pictures. And I've, you know, still am so many years later. You're like, freaking almost 40 years now, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So was acting always the path, the passion, or was there any other aspect of production that interested you, or even something outside of filmmaking that maybe you thought about at some point?
You know, yeah. You know, you're not going to believe this, but I wanted at first to be an Apache helicopter pilot for the Army.
Okay.
Wow.
And what was that trigger there?
Well, you know, I didn't, you know, I had a really kind of wanderlust childhood, you know, I was doing a million things. I had 1,000 crappy jobs. I was a dishwasher for a while. I was a bus boy. I was a golf caddy. I had every shitty job that there ever was. And then I was a production assistant too, you know, which led me to acting finally. Mm. But not knowing what I wanted to do with my life, I thought, I think I'd like to blow shit up, as every young boy does at one point.
So totally sense.
Yeah, so I walked in the recruiting office, and the NCO said to me, "Hey, are you wearing glasses?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You want to be an Apache pilot?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, that ain't going to happen right now. He said, "But you could repair Apaches on the runway." And I went, "That doesn't sound
like fun."
No,
this fun.
I don't want to do that. So I kind of walked out of there. And then I wanted to be a cop, and I went to a year pre-law.
Wow.
And, you know, and that kind of faded when I first got, you know, I started taking a series of lousy jobs. And when I started to do, I did one day on an industrial film. That was the first thing I ever did. And for those who don't know what that is, an industrial film is an in-house movie made for that company.
It's how to fold sweaters at the Gap.
Exactly right. So yes. For Blumhouse, it's, you know, how to take, how to pleasantly let down screenwriters or directors when they go, "Hey, you should read my script because it's freaking awesome."
Ryan, does this video exist?
That is a skill.
And I did this particular one because it was Detroit. I did it for GM. You know, it was about how great they treat their workers. It was. And there were so few actors. And then the next week, I remember I did one for the UAW about how lousy GM was to them.
I was going to say, did you get worked up in your own head, like going, "Oh my God, I got to get into character for this. Did you get all actorly about it?"
I did. GM employee.
Yeah, it was fun. And I did a bunch of them. I worked twice a week. You know, I was doing 2 industrial films a week for like a year there and living at home because I'm a square kid. You know, I don't really, at that time, I didn't drink or do any drugs. So I was just living at home and doing, and the first check I got was worth 3 weeks of doing dishes. And I went, "Well, I'm never going to wash a fucking dish again." In fact, right now at my house, there's a pile of dishes in my sink. I still hate to look at those things, you know. So I think we all do, but that has special resonance for me, I think.
Wow. So, it's a little, your early days on the IMDb are a little murky.
Yes.
But
yes.
I believe when I purchased the epic Blood Rage Blu-ray, which is a great Thanksgiving slasher.
The Thanksgiving slasher.
Yeah.
Yes. The only Thanksgiving slasher.
They claim on the disc
that
Condom Salesman is your first film role. Is this correct?
It's probably my first official film role.
Right.
The one where I got paid to do it, like as a feature. That was a bet I made with my father. As soon as I got out of high school, I was 17, I was done with all those jobs.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "I want to be an actor." And he said, don't do it. I wouldn't recommend it. I said, no, I really want to be an actor. He said, all right. And he did a wise thing. He said, I will give you, you want to be an actor? I said, yeah, I want to move to New York too. He went, okay. Go to New York, live with, I had some friends there. Said, go move in with these guys. I'm going to give you just enough and pay your rent and just enough for your food and your pictures and resume and everything else is on you. And if you don't get a job within a year, you come back and you work for me, you go back to school.
Wow.
And I went, that's going to be easy. It's the easiest year of my life. And so I'm 17, can't even vote or drink. And I'm in Manhattan. This is like 1983.
So Manhattan's a little rough around this time, right?
It is. I was in the East Village. Now you say, oh, East Village, you blah, 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 blah. But then East Village was, it was only like 6 years removed from Taxi Driver East Village.
That's that's like right at like Abel Ferreira East Village.
Yeah, there's like pimps, hookers, crackheads. I mean, it was nasty. Anyhow, so it was the loneliest, worst year of my life. All my friends were drinking, partying down at Michigan State at U of M. You know, meeting girls, having fun, getting good grades. And there I was freezing my ass off in New York City. In fact, I remember one time I was so broke that I would collect pennies in this jar. And there was this, it was before Ray's Original Pizza, but there was a pizza joint right across the street. It was the only place in like a restaurant right around the corner. So I collected pennies and a slice cost 99 cents in those days. And after about a week, I'd have 99 pennies. And so I'd walk up to the desk. I was so excited, and I dropped 99 cents.
Oh, God.
And there's a line out the door, and a man, you could just hear and feel people wanting to rip my pennies off. And so this guy's like counting 99 pennies, and he slides this giant slice over to me. And at that point, I'd only been eating Cheerios and, you know, potatoes. And so I was so excited, and I sat down on the corner of 13th and 3rd, and this delicious, awesomely greasy slice of pizza slips off the plate and lands, plops, right on 13th Street. And I thought, I hate this fucking city. I hate living here. I don't want to be an actor anymore. And I bought my ticket to go home. And that was like almost the end of the year. And then I got a call from this agent who took pity on me and said, there's this movie. You know, if you want to be, this guy is supposed to be a condom salesman in a bathroom. It sounds great. And I did it. And then, you know, I sold my ticket, finished the shoot and flew home and went, well, I did it, Dad. And he went, all right, well, you know, there you go. So you can be an actor, I guess, you know. So that was it.
Wow. Did you, after that, stay in New York? Did you go back to Detroit or to LA?
I had such a checkerboarded life. You know, I mean, I was in New York. I went to four different universities trying to find a theater department that matched my work habits because they were all so bullshitty. You know, they're like film school. You know, they just crank out, you know, these Legos basically of actors and filmmakers who weren't going anywhere. But I'd already worked a great deal.
Yeah.
I'd already done like a year or two of actual work and been auditioning. And I thought none of these schools were helping me until I found the University of Detroit. And they had a sink or swim mentality. They said to you, you go and be an actor in our plays that you're paying for because you're a student. But we're also going to let anybody who wants to audition, which I thought was a radical idea. So these pro actors in Detroit were getting parts over us, even though we were paying these outrageous fees. But it reminded you, this is what it's like outside. So you better get good, and you better get good really, really fast, which I did, you know. And those professors, I still remember them, Arthur Beer, David Riegel, Mary Bremer. They were so instrumental in everything that I did. I really – without them, I don't think I would have had the career I had, you know.
Yeah.
It's just you have to get good and you have to be aggressive. And, you know, I mean, there is a time and a place for Zen, beautiful L.A. meditation of your life and letting things flow over you and all that kind of stuff. But there's not many of them. It's a pretty aggressive business.
Yeah. Do you remember what film, and I know this is kind of like, again, murky, especially in the early years, but what's the first film that you were on that you thought – wow, this is a real movie. I think this is a shot. I think I'm going to keep doing this. Well, what was like the turning point movie for you?
Turning point.
I'm a professional actor.
Or was it Blood Rage?
No, it wasn't Blood Rage. It was a bunch of other crappy ones too. I was getting sort of down on the business, but until I did this movie called Lunatics, A Love Story, and it was directed by a guy named Josh Becker, who's also from Detroit.
Yeah.
And that movie was odd. It's the only like oddly dramatic, fully dramatic movie I did. I guess there's fantastical elements in it. And it's not really horror.
Right.
But I finished that and I thought, well, that's a quality movie. I think I could, if I'm going to try and find more of these, and it gave me a taste for that. So it was that one, you know, but people didn't really know who I was until, you know, not even when I did Twin Peaks or any of the other shows I'd done until I'd done this NBC show called Sequest, you know, the Steven Spielberg monster of a show, which at that time was the most expensive show on TV.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, like, you know, now I think.
Shiner. Do you remember this? It was like Star Trek Underwater.
Yeah, it was Star Trek Underwater. I mean, I think it was like $1.5 million an episode, which is normal drama now.
Yeah.
But in those days, remember, this is like $1993. So it would translate to around $3.5-4 million an episode. It's expensive.
Yeah.
Now, did everything drastically change after that?
Did
you start getting recognized everywhere?
I did, yeah. I did. And I remember one of the first times anyone asked for my autograph, I was on a plane with my dad. We were flying to Florida for the third season. He was going to help me look for a place to live. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, can I have your autograph?" And my dad said, "What did you say to him?" And that's what I said. I said, "What'd you say?" I didn't know if I heard him. I said, "Can I have your autograph? You know, I'm a big fan." And my dad said, "Don't sign anything. You don't know what's in the paper. Don't sign it." You know, he thought like it was like a trick, you know. I was like, "No, I think this is legit." I mean, I looked, it was just a piece of paper, and it was the first one I'd ever signed. So, so I thought, wow, this is much, much bigger than I thought. I didn't anticipate being recognized. You know, it was just something that sort of happened. I think a lot of actors get into it for that, but that wasn't my first, you know, desire at all.
Lunatics is interesting. And have you seen this recently?
No, I know that. But
I remember catching it when I was in high school or film school. I think it came out. And you carry the whole film. I mean, that's your movie. I mean, like, was there, you just dove right in. Was there any apprehension to kind of carrying a film on your own? What did you learn from that kind of carried you into, you know, DSV?
You know, right now, I would, if it were now, like, and DSV, someone gave me, that's right. Yeah. If someone gave me a film, I would have apprehension. I'd be nervous, and I'd be like, "Oh my God, I gotta figure this character and the blog, I gotta do the research." But I was just too young to have any fear, you know, as, you know, that's why the Army wants young soldiers. They have no regard for their mortality or anyone else's, and that also makes good young actors too. You know, is that they go on set, they're like, "I don't care, hang me up from this wire." "Yeah, cool, man. What? How 20 hours of working? Cool, awesome, man. Whatever. Yeah, you want me to take these pills? I don't care what they are. Let's go take them."
Yeah.
So I didn't really think about that at that moment. You know, you just in retrospect. But that movie, oddly, has resonance, and I don't know why. Yeah. When I go to these fan conventions, the ones that you and I met, in fact, there were a bunch of people with that movie, and the movie has not been released on DVD ever. Sony's just sitting on it for whatever reason they are. I don't know. Yeah. But those DVDs, because that's all they ever, excuse me, those VHSs, pardon me, were all they ever made, and the movie's so weirdly popular that they sell for about $150 on eBay. That crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's crappy copies selling for $30, $40 of that. You know, just a weird, weird cult movie that hit people in the right way. And you just have to get lucky. You know, that's
Was going to say, it was a time, too, when that came out, when there was just like this kind of people were applauding independence. There was a lot of interesting movies coming out of the independent film scene, too.
There was. But still, none of those were horror, you know. My heart was always in it.
Yeah.
And so I went out looking for that stuff, you know. And I would – and when that movie was done, and right around, you know, the Sequest time, like in the early 90s, I would – I loved it. I loved horror. I loved everything. I knew stuff like I knew Jacques Tourneur's movies. Mm-hmm. I knew old Alfred Hitchcock. I knew what was ripped off from Hitchcock for modern thrillers and horrors. I was just into it, you know? And so when I would go read for these directors in those days, like Wes Craven and Tobe Hooper and John Carpenter and stuff, now the late Wes Craven, so sad. Yeah. And also, oddly, I read for late Romero too now. Everybody's dying, man.
Yeah,
shit.
No.
But hey, all right, that's the way it goes. But so anyhow, read for those guys, and in those days, horror was not cool to do, right? Horror was something that, now it's cool. Mm-hmm. Not like every young star wants to do horror. I'm sure, you know, Gal Gadot is probably going, "Yeah, I think I might like to do a horror film." Like, I don't know, that sounds cool. Okay. Those days it wasn't so. You did horror and it was like just a little bit better than doing porn. You're supporting yourself, but that was it. So I'd go to these readings and I'd be really enthused, you know, and these directors would be like, "Oh, you are." Oh, you know, so that was something that, you know, I think that part's partly why I got into that cycle of working with those guys in those days, you know.
Yeah. Can you talk about reading for Wes on the
Sure. I that particular audition I remember so well because I had recently got to LA and I knew a director of photography from Detroit who knew a casting director. And things were a little looser in those days, too, with regard to actors, I think, you know, and word of mouth, I think, went a little farther. And so this DP went, check out this guy. And so this DP goes, calls me up and goes, hey, I heard you're this type. Because we didn't have computers then, you know, you just have to go on what they look like. So, heard you're about 6 feet, you know, brown hair, brown eyes, well, kind of nerdy, is that right? I went, yeah. He goes, okay, I'm going to pick you up. And you busy right now? I went, no. He goes, I'm going to pick you up in 15 minutes. I'm going to take you to Wes Craven's office. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, we got to do this now. I said, okay. So he pulls up to my apartment, which I was sharing with like five other guys. I hop into this convertible. It was a Ford Mustang convertible. And we went down the 101. And I was like, oh, my God, this is so Hollywood. Jesus Christ. I'm in a casting director's car in Hollywood and stuff like that. We get to the beach, and Wes Craven's office was there, and Santa Monica. And I walked in. There he was. And I was like, holy shit, that's the guy that directed Last House on the Left. Oh, my God, he's right there. sat down, and Wes went, you ready? And first I thought he couldn't have been Wes Craven because I thought it was a college professor. I was like, how can that be the guy that directed that? But, he, you know, that's his vibe. You know, he had a sport coat. Patches, elbow patches, you know. He was just missing the pipe.
Right.
That's all he was missing. And so I read for him, and he right then and there, he went, that was really good. And he just said, okay. Who's your agents? I said, I don't have any agents. He went, you don't? I said, no. He goes, well, get one. Jesus. And then call us back in a couple days, and we'll make a deal with you.
Yeah.
I went, wow. Okay. And then I drove back, and that was it. So that was a rare opportunity and a rare experience.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah,
five roommates that you had helped you get an agent? Did anybody of them?
No, actually none of them were.
You could probably just call up an agent and say, I have a pending deal.
They were all they were just all in school. So I actually had to make the rounds of agents. Goes, right. Hey, I have a feature film. You want to be my agent?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's how I got an agent. You know?
And this was for Shocker, correct?
It was for Shocker.
Yeah. And
it was Peter Berg's first movie. That was probably my second or third movie, but that was Peter Berg's very first movie, I think.
Yeah. Was that your first studio picture? Was that done for Universal?
I think it was Universal.
Yeah.
And that's where I met Mitch Peligi, who I'm friends with to this day. I just saw him 2 weeks ago, and it was funny. We just talk about that, and there's a picture of that. It's on my website now of me and Mitch, and we look like we're 10. I mean, but it was hilarious. But
was there much difference from your perspective going on to the set of Shocker as opposed to some of the smaller films you'd done? That's what I meant by the studio question.
Oh, I'm sorry. God, it was like day and night. You know, they went, this is your trailer. I went, what? That's all for me? And like it was like a three banger, but at that time I was like, holy crap, this is all mine. The toilet's all mine. You know, so yeah, it was a big deal. It's costume rent. And, you know, it was all pro deal, you know. It was all pro deal. So yeah, it meant a lot to me at that time. It was really, I was shocked. It was shocking. No pun intended.
Yes. I'm going to jump right to the kind of one thing that I'm super stoked about. Just talking about, I think, you know, what really struck me as a budding film fan and filmmaker growing up, it was like with like little bits. They were little parts.
Oh, man.
Hard Target, Dark Man, you know, I mean, like these, I just want to talk about Dark Man really quick.
Sure.
You know, obviously, Sam was kind of getting into more superhero territory. It felt like dark superhero territory.
Yes, that's right.
Going to the Fangoria show, getting a pin that said, who is Dark Man? I'm like, I don't know, but tell me.
That was
you know, can you just talk about a little bit about the experience on that? Because obviously, you had worked with the team, and it was more horror related. But this was skewing more tonally into a different space. So what was it like being part of the – I mean, were you – what did you observe, I guess, on that set in terms of how the team was working?
In terms of team, you mean like the actors and the director? And that movie felt like a bunch of buddies all getting together. That acting group and the filmmaking group really felt intimate, and I think partly because it was a low budget film.
Yeah.
And you get to know on a low-budget film, and I mean, it's a low-budget studio.
Right, exactly.
So it's not like an indie at all. It was a studio picture. But
yeah, it still felt big.
It was a big movie, but still, it's small enough so that you knew everybody on the crew after a few days, you know? So it felt really intimate. And I think that translated into the acting and the directing, and it felt like you were doing a play or something. I don't know. That was the vibe I remember.
Well, it's interesting. I guess what I'm getting at is it's tricky tonal balance, you know, because it can lean a little bit super superhero-y, a little bit more revenge drama, a little bit more horror story, you know. So I'm sure as an actor in the film, it's a tricky balance.
It was an interesting. I mean, that movie had a lot of writers on it. It was surprising that it turned out as well as it did, script-wise. You know, there was like eight of them, I think, or something. But it wound up working very well, I think, and it was nice to work with the late Larry Drake, and he was really, you know, and a great acting partner, you know. And I was scared at that movie too, because I was like, well, this is a big studio movie. You know, I was nervous. I really wanted to do well because I knew that would have an impact on the rest of my career. And he walked me through a lot of stuff, you know, just stuff to do on a daily basis, what you do when you're on set and stuff like that. The stuff that I didn't get on, say, Shocker and other movies like that.
Any friendly advice from Liam Neeson?
No, he was a Liam sweet man, but he was a quiet man. Yeah. I think he's kind of got that Irish stoicism thing going on. So I didn't talk to him too much, but I did talk a great deal to Larry Drake and the other actors as well. You know, so it was a lot of fun to do. You know,
that's great. Yeah.
Well, I actually love your character's relationship with Larry Drake in the movie. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think it might have been one of the first on screen sort of gay relationships that I remember in a movie seeing. I mean, I think there was always hints of them, but. It was, you know.
Is that stuff that you guys figured out as actors? Or?
We did. We figured out as actors that, you know, Larry and I were like, well, you know, if they're always hanging, I think it was Larry's idea, like, well, they're always hanging out together, you know, and why does he like them so much? The actors do that. We go through the backstory and went, well, maybe they're just gay. Right. And so that's why they like each other, you know. So we implied that pretty heavily in some of the subtext and stuff. I think people picked up on it. It was fun to do.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, and Hard Target. Like, how did that
– how did that even happen?
Oh, Rob Tappert, my old friend Rob Tappert produced that. And he called me up and said, you want to come down and do this? Rob's really very good friend, and he's very very fine producer, and he's got a great eye and stuff. But he said, hey, you want to come down to New Orleans and
– be the guy.
Yeah, be the guy. So I went down there, and I waited a week to do – about 5 minutes worth of shooting because they kept delaying it. So, you know, whatever, being, you know, 23 and you're in New Orleans, you've been paid trips. So I had a good time.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, yeah. So it was fun. I remember John Woo he's a fine director. You know, he's created an entire genre by himself, of course. And but his grasp of English wasn't very good, but he had knew exactly what was happening, but he didn't speak English very well. And he said to me, you know, he was in a hurry by the time they shot I'd waited a week, and then they were just in an absolute hurry. And we started shooting. And he said, you stand here? Yeah. You walk it to the other end of the sidewalk. And then go. That was all he said to me. So, you know, I said my line. I did the thing, and they got it in two takes, and it was over.
You helped each other out.
That was it. That was like, okay. And I caught a flight that night. It was the weirdest movie experience of my entire life.
It turned out wonderful, though.
Oh, yeah. I thought so, too. I thought it was a lot of fun movie, and, you know.
Well, it was just a culmination of all things that I loved.
Oh, yeah, you
know, growing up. It was like fucking John Woo. Still, and then, you know, and then it's just like, and Jean-Claude Van Damme and Lance Henriksen. And there's a Raimi in this?
Have you watched it?
This is fantastic.
Have you watched it recently? It's just a feast for
Becca,
the eyes.
I watch it regularly at Christmas.
Jean-Claude Van Damme, I remember when I first met him, it was just when he was getting ready to do his first big movie with directed by Sheldon Lettich, but I can't remember the name of it, the one that made him a big star. Anyway, we were at Universal and having lunch, and at the end of lunch, he got up and sitting there, you know, in the commissary at Universal are all these execs. He didn't know any of them, but he walked over and shook every exec's hand and said, my name is Jean-Claude Van Damme. I'm going to make you a lot of money. Hey, you, what is your name? Phil Eberman, I'm going to make you a lot of money. And you, I'm going to make... And so they were all completely confused and kind of annoyed, but I thought, my God, that guy's got balls.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. So next time I go to Universal...
Is that what you're going to do?
My name is Ryan Turek. You still have to do the accent.
No fucking clue who I am.
I don't even know where my accent's from.
I wanted to touch on this quickly because obviously you did a couple of episodes of Twin Peaks.
Yes.
But I think it's interesting in retrospect because you were in this towards the end of the second season.
As like heavy metal teen?
Yeah.
And I was just curious about that experience because obviously now there's the big revival and people are, people have never stopped talking about the show. But no, I was too young to remember the fuss. I discovered it much later. So what was it like? Because I know the first season was like all over every, you know, front cover of Rolling Stone and like talked about nonstop. And then you're kind of in the middle of this.
I'm in the very, I think the last two episodes of
right,
the show.
Right. It's like this kind of like cult phenomenon.
But, yeah.
So looking back on that, was that weird stepping into that world?
No, it suited me very well. It was not weird. It was, it wasn't even that intimidating because of, because of David Lynch himself, you know, you walked into the audition room and it was like somebody's dad walked in there. I was like, whose dad is in here? When's the director and the producer coming in? You know, he's just, that's got that vibe. He's very unassuming. And so that I think I was relaxed going in. And also I didn't care. I didn't know about that. I didn't have anything to lose. And so I gave it 180 degrees, you know, I'm just a nerdy kid, you know, but, I just was playing rock and roll kid. And so that was, you know, either they're going to love you or my take on everything I ever do is if most of them hate you and only one of them loves you, you're doing it right because you're eliciting an incredible response from people. Mm. I think most people in this business prefer middle of the road and safe because they don't want too many. If just enough people like them, they can move on to the next level. That's never been my MO though.
Right.
So I've... you know, if you're lucky, most people will love you and a few will absolutely hate you. I've never met too many people that just thought I was okay. Most people think I suck and they can't stand me or they love me. So right. I feel like I'm doing things right. And I'm not saying I've got some universal appeal or something. I just don't deny that I'm me.
Right. You hit the nail on the head. If you elicit a response either way, it's a good thing.
I think so.
Because you're making people respond.
I think so. I think so.
A quick obscure one I want to throw out there. Just because I actually like this movie a lot, I discovered it on DVD. You did a little movie in the early 90s called Skinner with Tracy Lords where you're like a serial killer.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I think this came in like a little box set that I bought with like three other movies. And I was pleasantly surprised. I thought you were really good in it.
Oh, thanks. So thanks. That movie was that has weird memories for me. That movie. First, it's nice. I run into Tracy frequently. You know, Tracy Lords, she's a sweet girl, and we both talk about that movie. And you know what a bizarre experience that was for both of us. It was just a very strange movie. First of all, it was made weirdly. It was made with weird funding from. We didn't really know where the funding came from. It was dubious, I'll say. And then the movie, of course, it was like one of these like. Five or six small house sort of ripoff versions of Hannibal Lecter, you know, Sons of the Lambs kind of a thing. And in that movie, my character, a serial killer, goes and this unassuming guy goes and just finds these prostitutes and kills them and, you know, skins them all kinds of stuff, gross stuff and crazy stuff. At the end of the movie, as we were wrapping after the party and everything, the director, Ivan Nagy, who was a nice guy, we really liked him. He was like the one sort of bright spot, gets arrested. And we go, why did he get arrested? What the hell happened? We were all pretty shocked, you know? And we learned Ivan Nagy was Heidi Fleiss's. Remember Heidi Fleiss?
Oh, yeah.
The madam of Hollywood. It was her pimp. He was the one. He was the one who was in the doing the books. He was the one in the background. He was the one who would hire the thugs to make sure the girls were, you know, not abused and stuff like that.
Right.
But he actually wasn't a terrible film director either, we learned.
The director of Skinner, I love it.
And yeah, it was very strange. And during the movie, there were a ton of these extras who were hookers. Of course, that's what I do in the movie. I kill them.
Right.
But there were also a lot of BGs, you know, a lot of background players who were also hookers. And that one of them I thought was very strange at that point, came up to me and went, because extras always do, hey, you know, who's your agent and how do I, you know, if you, I know we're not supposed to talk to you, but I really want to know, like, you know, how'd you get into the business and do you have any tips and, you know, anybody I can talk to? Because you want to know, as I did, you know, when I was starting out too. Not one asked me, not one. I was like, wow, this is really weird. And I realized they don't need another job.
They don't care.
This wasn't their day job.
They're probably making more than anybody else.
Sorry, or rather, this was their day job. They had a night job, I guess I should say, yeah.
Wow.
It was very bizarre and weird, but that is a true story. And I think he's probably, I don't know if he's still serving time or not, but it was crazy. It was really weird. I mean, I don't know if that, you know, it's just the world of, you know, low budget, weird filmmaking that in those days that stuff happened.
And I think it's another one that's only on VHS.
It came out on DVD. I had it,
it
on DVD.
Yeah, it's on DVD.
It was on a double bill with something called like The Surgeon, I think. That's how I picked it up.
The what? What's it called?
It was a two-pack with the Surgeon.
The Sturgeon.
The Surgeon and the Whitefish.
But I hope somebody does a Blu-ray of that because the special features already sound like it'd be a fascinating documentary.
Oh, man, it was very, very weird.
I like the write-up on IMDb. A decent looking lad named Dennis Skinner. Skinner, they worked that into the character title.
Yes, that's nice.
I love it.
Yeah, that's nice.
That was a cool movie. I'm sorry, I just had to mention it.
Well, one of the things that we kind of like skipped was Candyman, which I feel is like the best horror movie of the 90s, I feel. Like.
I thought so too. I thought a guy named Bernard Rose directed it. He was still making horror movies. He's making them in England, back home in England now.
He just did a great retake of Frankenstein.
He did.
I saw it. I thought it was great.
I thought, great job with it. Fix my pop filter there. It's dying, falling. There we go. Yeah, he did. It was unique and scary. It was a great take on it. You know, I think what happened with Bernard is he made Candyman. It got so much acclaim. Then I think he wasn't interested in doing any of the sequels. Which may or may not have been a good decision for him. And then he did the Gary Oldman Beethoven movie. I can't remember the name of it.
Immortal Beloved.
Which bombed, unfortunately.
I don't recall that being a really good movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It was really good. I thought so too, but it didn't do well. Maybe I shouldn't say it bombed. I don't think it made it money that they wanted it to make, and they're paying Gary Oldman, who was at the peak of his earning career, a lot of money. And so I think then he sort of went to England and finishing up his career there at the moment. But Candyman was a really unique picture with somehow Bernard got Philip Glass to do the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and Philip Glass doesn't do movie soundtracks very often, if at all. Maybe two or three. I don't know how many. Yeah. Maybe he's done a lot. I don't think so.
No.
So that was really impressive. And Virginia Madsen, of course, and the gala was, I had a small part in that, but Marianne Elliott, wonderful Marianne Elliott. It was a wonderful experience. And Bernard is one of these rare guys who, you know, most directors are pretty stoic.
Yeah.
You know, or they're yellers, you know, but they're typically stoic people because there's so much going on and you have to either hold it all in or you explode and let it out. But Bernard had a third way, which I'd never, ever seen before or since. And he would show his delight like in crazy ways. You know, he would smoke these Marlboro Lights all day long on set. These are the days when everybody smoked on sets. And he would clap like a little kid. So like in rehearsals and he saw something that worked, he'd go, this is how he would laugh. He'd go, he'd do that. And at first I thought he was completely crazy and I was worried until I realized he just did this with everything and that he liked. And there was no denying his joy. When something was working, you saw it. And when not, you know, he was stone-faced English guy. But all the other times, man, there was no doubt. And I thought that was a really refreshing way to, you know, direct actors.
Right.
You know, because you knew it was working at that point.
Yeah. I would love a special edition of that first movie because I actually interviewed Tony for the second one and he told so many great stories, including that I think this is public knowledge, Bernard hypnotized Virginia for some of the scenes that she's supposed to be dead.
Yes, he did.
He actually hypnotized her. So when she's kind of out of it, she was really kind of out of it.
He had actually hypnotized
the actor. That's true.
Did he do this with all the actors?
No, just Virginia. Just Virginia. He made sure he's one of these, you know, I don't know. There seems to be two sort of directors in this world. Ones that love their crews and hate the actors. And then there's others that are the opposite. And Bernard loved his actors and typically was annoyed by his crews. Not all the time, but I shouldn't say annoyed. I think that's harsh. I think he had a particular love for the actors and a less, I guess, of a romance with his crews. You know, some of the more famous ones that were the opposite were, say, like John Huston, the famous John Huston, who berated all of his actors frequently and made sure they were humiliated and loved his crews, would take them out, cigars, drinks every night, all on him. You know, I think like Treasure of Sierra Madre, I heard stories about from different crew members and Bogey and stuff talking about that movie. And, you know, Huston would say to Bogey, "What's your fucking problem, Bogey? Jesus H. Christ. Oh my God, I could have fucking get a dolphin to fucking be better than you." But at the end of the day, he would dismiss all of his actors, you know, like they were cattle, and just take his crew out to dinner, you know, but would make all the actors pay for themselves. He would never, ever spend a dime on them. But that's the kind of guy he was. But, you know, but I think Bernard really, really dug his actors tremendously, and it was nice.
Yeah. What, you know, as you were going on in your career, you know, what were you seeing change maybe just in the genre or the filmmakers you were working with? Were you seeing like kind of, I don't know, increase in quality or fluctuations in how people worked? I mean, like, it's just funny because the horror genre comes in tides, you know?
It does.
And you see, you get a really great period of great horror films, and then you get kind of periods when you get Skinner, you know, which are
which is good.
Okay.
Which is
No,
but
it's okay.
Then there's definitely more like Wishmaster movies where it's just like buckets of money.
Well, I mean, like, I'm just talking about, just like where it's, you know, I think Skinner and Wishmaster represent, you know, completely oddball. Like the industry allows oddball voices to come through.
It does.
You know, and then occasionally you'll get nothing but complete mainstream play for the wide audience horror
stuff, that's right. Yeah. Well, you know, some of that has to do with I don't say this in a political sense, but these days it's very hard not to say anything that isn't political. So take it out, take it out of that context. When the corporations took over the studios, you get corporate guys making corporate decisions. I think, you know, when you get a few dudes who can break away from that and make individual decisions, you get finer horror pictures. Mm-hmm. I think it's as simple as that. Yeah. And I don't, in one sense, blame a lot of directors and audiences get very angry, like, oh, you know, it's all corporate, blah, 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 and a bunch of blah. Yeah, but you have to understand that the people that run those studios and make those decisions all went to business school. They all have MBAs. And in all business schools, they all teach the same thing, which is when you have a product that's selling well, you don't change the formula. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
So those guys, that's all there is to it. So I think there's a lot of that in horror.
Yeah.
But then there's just, you know, thank God we've got, you know, all these independent movies now too.
Right. No, exactly.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. No, it's just interesting to see. I mean, you know, someone who's seen it come and go, you know what I mean? Like from Evil Dead 2, which is like a great pinnacle of the 80s, you know, of just doing a bunch of guys going into a gymnasium and shooting fucking crazy ass horror to, you know, something like, I don't know, like The Grudge, which I really appreciate as a film, you know, that's very studio horror.
Yeah. It is. Though there's a version of The Grudge that Shimizu made that isn't studio. Mm. You remember he made that movie three times.
Yes.
Yeah.
One, two, three.
That's right, yeah.
Same movie.
Right.
And his first iteration of it is much more gritty.
Oh, it's insane.
It's crazy and weird, you know, and I'm not even sure if there's a subtitled version. I think he just made it for Japanese audiences. I don't know. Somebody
put it
out somewhere. But the one I saw, I didn't have subtitles, and I don't speak Japanese. It was challenging, to say the least.
I revisited that over the last Halloween season because I hadn't seen it.
The Grudge?
The Grudge. Yeah. No, The Grudge. And I was surprised by how much he actually did get away with, because it still feels very abstract in terms of its narrative and structure, you know?
It is. Also, it's just coming from a Japanese mythology as opposed to a Western mythology, which is essentially that you don't have to do a bad, immoral thing to be punished.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there is to it. In Western, you have to.
Yeah.
That was one of the fascinating things about The Grudge, is that it just existed. There was like, it didn't matter who you were or whether or not you walked into it. It just kind of existed. And actually, there's a short film that I think predecessed the films. Like, it's just a little short segment that Shimizu did when he like first came up with the concept. And it's pretty much, you can find it on YouTube. And it's pretty much just a girl walking down the street, and then she sees this creepy girl with like messed up face, and then she has infected it. And that's all there is.
Yeah.
It spreads quickly.
It's pretty cool.
Have you seen Sadako versus Kayako yet? The Grudge versus the Ring?
No.
Okay.
I haven't.
It's actually pretty excellent. It just came out last year.
It's fun.
It sounds fun.
Yeah.
I think I'd like to see that.
Well, what I liked about the Grudge is that they just took a bunch of Americans and did a fish out of water story as opposed to trying to translate that kind of the Grudge and just going, well, let's just set it in Dallas, Texas and see what happens.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I was just going to say
it was one of the more smart, like the more clever ways to do one of the Japanese adaptations, because all the other ones were like, how do we create this culture in America?
I mean,
and many of them didn't work.
Horror is a different sensibility. So trying to take what's scary in Japan and make an American version of it is a really difficult challenge, which is why it's like, well, let's keep it to the Japanese thing.
Yes.
Just put Americans in that setting.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, and some things translate better than others.
Yeah.
But a lot of their horror seems to translate well. I think a lot of Japanese culture seems to translate well to American audiences, you know? Not everything, but certainly, my God, we certainly love what John Woo did for action film. You can't watch an action film without referencing John Woo.
Yeah.
And of course, without all the great masters before him doing actual karate.
Right.
You know, before there was guns, there was just karate. So we owe a lot to Japan in terms of our action pictures. All the ones we're seeing this summer, we owe a great deal.
Yeah. Obviously, I'm sure I speak for all of us. We all grew up with a great affinity and love for the entire Evil Dead franchise.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
And there is nothing more thrilling than the latest season of Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Oh, yeah.
Getting to see you come back in multiple capacities.
Yeah. It's fun. I think for those who know me and worked with me, they sort of insist and I don't say no.
Right.
Because I love it. And in fact, I was just talking with this weekend at Comic-Con with my old friend Mike Richardson, who runs Dark Horse Comics. He had some – Mike was – I had dinner with him and he was telling me, Mike is like – I think he's 6 foot.
He's tall.
Nine, maybe almost 7 feet. Still plays basketball. He's huge. And highly intelligent and interesting guy. And he said, you know, hey, I got this movie and you're going to play all these different parts. Here's the parts I got for you. Like that's his pitch to me to get me in the movie, you know? And the truth of the matter is that is exciting to me.
Right.
That I get to do multiple things, you know? Also being just going back to all the little tiny parts I've done, it really is like a bottle rocket theory that I got that if you're only working for 3 hours, you can burn the fuel 150%, you know? You don't have to pace yourself like you do with a TV show that you're in or a movie that you're starring in. You just burn it out, man. I think that's a wonderful thing you can do, you know, that stars are not allowed to do. Mm-hmm. Just get too exhausted, you know, but I can do that. So it's kind of awesome.
I love seeing you. I think Army of Darkness is the first movie where I was like, I think I've seen that guy already.
That one was fun. That particular one was shooting. That was fun because I would just hear about my brother, you know, shooting this movie, and then he would call me, or I would see him like the day before, and he'd be like, "Hey, are you busy tomorrow?" I'd be like, "No," and he goes, "Okay, can you play this like warrior on this parapet?" I went, "Yeah, okay." So I come in, I drive all the way out to Palmdale, you know, which is for those who don't live in LA, it is a drive.
It's That's like an hour and a half.
Yeah. In good traffic, it's like good traffic. Yeah, we'd go out there and shoot. That's what the set was, and you know, we would. So they'd make me up into this medieval dude, and I did this scene, and then I'd go home and thinking that was it, and then like the next 2-3 nights, I'd get a call like 10 o'clock at night. Hey, you do anything tomorrow? Well, no. Great. Can you be on set tomorrow at 9? I'll see you then. So I didn't even know what I was doing. So it was like actor, you know, it was like character roulette. I didn't even know what was happening until I got to set, you know. But that's part of the fun of that movie. I think partly, not that it wasn't an extremely rehearsed movie with regard to the action sequences and special effects, but, you know, a lot of the smaller stuff in there was like doing a community theater play. It had that vibe like, damn, anything goes here, man. I mean, we are going to rip this shit to pieces. It's awesome. So it's rare to – I don't know if that – you'll ever find that frequently unless you're doing a comedy or – I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever find that again, that experience, you know, unless I did do community theater, you know. Strangely, my lawyer is also the lawyer of Robert Ludlum. you know, the famous, yes. the late Robert Ludlum, yeah. you know, Born Identity and stuff. And I asked this, my lawyer one time, I go, what's Robert Ludlum doing? I mean, this is before he died, yeah. you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, he lives in his hometown. And now for the last 10 years, he's been writing plays for the community theater that is located in a strip mall behind his house.
Oh.
And I thought, damn, I'd like to see some of those
plays.
But I think I don't know. Maybe he doesn't want them known, but that's all he was interested in doing. And I can't say that I blamed him. I mean, in one sense, like you do sort of like, you want to find that feeling again.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to lose it. You can lose it as, you know, I've been a very lucky man. I've had a lot of fortune in my life. I've been in a lot of movies and television shows and directed things. But I do understand you want that feeling that mm-hmm. you don't get as budgets get larger. So
I think we all have that moment in LA where we're suddenly like, we miss what pushed us into it.
Absolutely. And I think it's not only true with this business. I think it's true with everybody and mm-hmm. every business. You know, you get to a point in your life, you go, man, I guess I'm not sure. Some dude working for Dow Chemical now doing some big corporate shit probably has a beautiful home in Midland, Michigan. And at one point he was like a chemist at home, you know, inventing stuff. He probably wants that again. You get that feeling and you want that vibe again, you know.
Does it still excite you to you know, challenge yourself and get new roles in movies and TV and stuff like that? I mean, I'm sure it's different because you've done it for so long, but do you still get a thrill out of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I get a total thrill, but now I have less to lose. So I'm back to kind of where I was, you know, like I don't have to prove myself anymore. Mm-hmm. So now when I go audition, I'm like, look at this shit. I'm not saying that I'm obnoxious in the audition or disrespectful.
I really just want you to walk in and say, look at this shit.
Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. In fact, I love this business. I'm very respectful of it. And yet now I don't have anything as much to prove to myself or anyone. So auditions are typically a little wilder. And I think I've been doing better, oddly, since that's happened, you know? You stop censoring yourself, you know, and you remember sort of that kind of stuff. So it's nice.
Right. I'm sorry. I wanted to go back to Ash vs. Evil Dead because we skipped over quickly.
Please.
I love that you played the best friend of Bruce's character. But again, Evil Dead 2 is one of my favorite movies of all time. And the fact that you reprised Henrietta.
Oh, yeah.
Is just so special. But at the same time, it's like there's so many notorious stories of how tortured you were.
Yeah, during it was the rough. First. Yes.
So how'd the second go-around go? I imagine it was a lot more pleasant than on Evil Dead 2.
You would imagine wrong. It was really,
were you back
really
in
hard.
Hell?
It was so hard. It was, well, before I did it, the producer, again, Robert Tappert, again, all those years later, Rob, you know, God bless him, he keeps, you know, hiring me for different things. And Rob said to me, well, you know, we want you to do Henrietta again. I thought that was great. I said, but, you know, it nearly killed me when I was the fittest. I was really fit and I was 20 and I was like working out and it just about killed me. I said, so now I'm 50. So I'm definitely dead. So like, what are we going to do? Like, we can't do the same thing we did before. And Rob said, oh, it's 30 years later. Are you kidding me? You know, prosthetics have progressed. Costumes have progressed. I mean, oh my God, you know, the spirit gum kind of stuff they used to put on your face, that's all different now. It's all different. It is a whole different experience. And I talked to the makeup guys down in New Zealand where we shot that. And they're like, oh yeah, mate, don't worry about a thing. Oh yeah, it's going to be easy, mate. Yeah, people do it all the time. Yeah, there you go. Hey, there you go. On you. Good on you, mate. There you go. So I went, okay, I guess it's going to be fine. Nope. no answer to your question. No. Just the same shit. It's just latex. Latex is basically wearing a rubber suit. The set was cooler.
Right.
So that was nicer. But yeah, I just about, you know, again, I didn't have an oxygen mask, but, you know, I can only do like 3/4 days and then I would basically just be too exhausted to do anything. But at one point down there, I remember because they had rebuilt the set. Mm-hmm. From Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
I mean, inch by inch, that thing was a perfect reproduction of that basement and of the cabin. And there I was in the Henrietta costume. In front of me was Bruce in his, you know, wearing what he wore 30 years ago. And we're looking at each other. And at one point, we had the worst, incredible deja vu. And Bruce said to me, I'll never forget this. He goes, well, Ted, it looks like we've gone a long way in 30 years. You know, we hadn't moved an inch. So, yeah. Anyway, it was it was fun to reprise it. The fans really dug the fact, I think, you know, I got into that suit again. And it's great. It's a great acting challenge. You know, it was, I'm making it sound like it was some kind of hell because you hear a lot of press about that. But the truth of the matter is, it's really invigorating to play like an old woman. You know, as an actor, as a character actor, it's the kind of stuff you hope for, you know, and to get to come up with all that stuff and come up with the way she talks and the way she moves. And, you know, I had to figure all that out again. And that was fun, you know, and the laugh, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all that kind of shit.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. So what's the future like? What do you have coming up?
Well, this last year I've been directing mostly. I've directed some commercials. Mm-hmm. I created an ad campaign for Starz Online Presence.
Okay. Oh, nice.
And so that was fun. That's kept me very busy. And now I'm getting ready to direct my first feature.
Excellent.
Which I'm sorry I didn't do earlier. But I'm very excited. I'm afraid I can't talk about it. But suffice it to say, it is a horror thriller.
Great.
I can't wait to do it. It's thrilling.
We can't wait to hear about it.
Oh, thank you. I'll tell you guys first. I promise whenever it comes out, if you're interested. So that's what's keeping me busy these days. And just the usual problems that you have when you're alive, like a pipe burst in my backyard and I have to go fix that shit. I have no food in my house and I have to go shop.
You got a pile of dishes that haven't been washed.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You as an actor, that is, well, I'm called, when most people see me, my name is, what have I seen you in?
Right.
That's what they call me. They go, what have I seen you in? Don't I know you? What have I seen you in? And you have to sort of list your resume and stuff. And that's the life of a guy like me in this horror business, you know. But I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way. Because if I was a big star, I mean, my God, the money would be awesome. But if I was a big star, you couldn't even go out to breakfast, I don't think, you know. I don't know how these guys do it. Mm-hmm. But I'm lucky. Anyway, when I go to conventions and people see me and I start to tell them that I have no food in my house, that I don't know what I'm going to make for dinner, that my dog's waiting for me at home. They looked so blankly at me. This look of they're dumbstruck. They're like, I think they think that all actors, I don't know, I'm not sure if they think an actor that they recognize cannot have the same problems that they might have.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that's the most fascinating thing to me, just watching that expression, you know, on their face is fascinating. Sometimes I'll just say that just to rile them up. Also, another thing too that I like to do, people do because I get a lot of double takes, but they don't know who I am.
Right.
And when I'm in an office building, say for an audition or something, going up an elevator only, I see people like peeking around and then they look quickly back. They go, they know me, but they don't know where from. And then I'll say to them, did you get the papers? Don't be late on those. Okay. And they go, yeah. No, I won't. Cause they don't know if they saw me in like, you know, board meeting that morning. And so it's mean, but it's fun to do.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
But I totally get that experience. I think I've told the story. I think I told it on Killer POV where we were, I was at the Whole Foods on the west side of LA. It was like my first year in LA and I was like standing there and I was picking up grapefruit and I look across and there was this face that I recognized. And all of a sudden I was like, oh God, I know him from somewhere. I'm going to be rude. Hi, how are you doing? And I smile and this guy just looks at me dumbfounded and I'm like, I don't know him. And then it wasn't until my husband came over that he pointed out that he was like one of the actors on Lost. And it wasn't a major role. It was just somebody on Lost. But I had just been like, hi, how are you? How have you been? Like, this guy doesn't know me for shit.
Yeah.
I get it.
I have one last question for you before we wrap up here. And just because, I mean, Lunatics might be the answer to this, but what of your films and your filmography is one that you're really proud of that not enough people have seen that you would like people to go back and discover?
Oh.
We will send all of our fans that way.
You know,
Which one should we look for?
It's so hard to – that question's hard to answer, and I'm not trying to be cryptic or anything.
Right.
It's just that I've yet to make a movie that I – thought was like a perfect movie that everyone should go see. I'm no good judge of myself. Mm. And that's for an audience to decide. So with that in mind, I'll answer your question, but just know that I don't think I've made that movie yet. Still, I would say Lunatics probably is a movie that few people have seen. It's a it's a solid drama. And Josh Becker did such a fine job with so little money. It's just amazing what can be done, you know, on a lower budget. I'd say that, you know. Yeah. The one, I think the one that I wish people maybe recognize me a little less for is this fantasy television show I did after Sequest called Xena Warrior Princess.
Oh, that one.
Vaguely familiar heard of it. Yeah, with heard of it.
It was so popular, and that lasted for 6 years. And oh my God, I mean, I'm grateful for it. It was a wonderful experience. The great Lucy Lawless starred in that. Renee O'Connor. It was a wonderful, amazing experience. And yet, you know, the fans that keep approaching me for that one, I wish they'd seen anything else I've done because I've done plenty of things, but that's the one that just seems to resonate worldwide the most.
Yeah. Wow.
It's like Benny Hill or something where like you don't really need to know the language to get that. I think that's a lot of it. And I don't, but that's my guess. I have no idea.
Are there Xena Warrior Princess conventions?
There are. I don't go to them. I don't go to them anymore.
Just fuels the fire.
I just can't take it. But there are, and God bless all those fans and all that stuff. I'm very grateful for them all, but I don't do that anymore. I don't, you know, it's not, nothing I'll have to say about it, you know.
Yeah.
After all those years of that show. Anyway, but I'm lucky. Actors sometimes never fall into a show like that, you know. I'm sure, you know, whoever. I mean, like, I don't know. Those actors from right now, I know those actors from, say, like Walking Dead are digging it. You know, we've all seen them at cons and stuff.
Sure.
They're all awesome guys, every last one of them, girls. But I'm quite sure in 10 years from now, they're going to be cursing that show because that's all they're going to be remembered for. Not all. I think it's just that probably perhaps if they're lucky and both unlucky, they'll be most remembered for that.
Yeah.
It's just something that happens to actors. And so horror has always been my bag. I'm sticking with it now. And now that I can pick my projects and I don't have to settle, so that's all I want to do.
That's great.
That's awesome. Ted, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And it's a wonderful podcast. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.